is The Hollywood Outsider, a weekly movie and TV podcast, which can be found at thehollywoodoutsider.com. We're also on Spotify, iHeartRadio, or your podcast app of choice. And you guys know that every once in a while we like to have interviews with independent filmmakers to talk about their films and what goes into making those films. Well, this time we've got kind of like a special interview because Troy Heinrichs and I, myself, Aaron Peterson, do another podcast called The Blacklist Exposed where we talk about the TV show The Blacklist. Recently, over this past summer, we had an interview with a great guy. His name is Anthony Pepe, and what he does is he's the makeup effects head for The Blacklist, and he's also worked on films like Spider-Man, he's worked on Hunger Games, he's worked on several films and television shows. He came by to talk about what a special makeup effects artist does, and when we did this interview, Troy and I agreed that, you know what, this would be perfect for The Hollywood Outsider as well, because he goes through... Yes, there are a lot of Blacklist-specific items in here, so if you're not a fan of the show, you might not understand some of the show specifics. But he does talk about what a makeup artist does, what the actors go through, the process, some of the films that he's worked on, the TV show that he worked on, what that environment is like, and just what that job is. And I thought it was fascinating because so many times we never hear the artists that do that work, their explanations of what that work is like. So... we agreed that when we got closer to when The Blacklist returns, which it returns on September 27th at 8 p.m. Eastern on NBC, we would re-air this, or I would bring this over here. And there's actually like 25 minutes of exclusive material that never aired on The Blacklist Exposed, specifically for The Hollywood Outsider. Anthony talks about that process. We talk about movies a lot. He really goes into his feelings on remakes and reboots and what it's like working in the industry when you are on the TV show and then you watch the TV show. And he also listens to the Blacklist Exposed podcast. So, and occasionally you'll hear actors' names like James. When we speak of James or Megan, that means Megan Boone and James Spader. Those are the two stars of the Blacklist. There's also Diego and Ryan and Harry, Amir. Those are names from the actual show of the Blacklist. Just to help you out, just to give you as a play-by-play. But a lot of this is just about the makeup itself and the effects itself and the work that goes into it. There's a lot of banter and a lot of interesting facts on the show, on Anthony himself and his profession of choice. I think you guys are going to love it. You love movies and TV. I think you're going to love this interview. I really hope you enjoy it. And without further ado, I should mention Troy Heinrichs, again, is going to be the other voice you hear. He is the co-host of The Blacklist Exposed with me. I'm sorry, the Academy Award-winning Blacklist Exposed with me. You guys getting tired of hearing that yet? I'm not. Definitely check that out. If you are a fan, go to theblacklistexposed.com or just find it in whatever app you use. But right now, here's our interview and with exclusive material with Anthony Pepe from The Blacklist. Well, Anthony, one thing I always ask anytime I interview anybody is what made you decide that you want to... Well, first, tell people what you do specifically, how you do it.
I'm the makeup department head for The Blacklist. I'm a makeup and special effects artist. I've been doing makeup for about 21 years now. I've done everything, feature films, television, commercials, music videos. Some of the more recent films I've worked on were the second Hunger Games movie, Catching Fire.
Did you touch Jennifer Lawrence at all, at her head?
No, or? I met her. I worked under V. Neal, the makeup department head at the time. I also worked on like the Amazing Spider-Man movies here in New York. And, you know, not in a department head capacity, but, you know, as part of the makeup teams. And... television, I've bounced around a lot on all the shows in New York. And then right about the time I moved upstate, because I lived in New York City, I moved upstate. About 6 months later, I get the call to come work on The Blacklist full time. So now I commute every day to the city. So I've been with The Blacklist now since season two.
Wow. So what made you, when you're, was it a moment when you were a kid? Was it a moment at some point in your life where you knew I want to do this? This is what I want to do with my life?
No, originally my plan was to be a Walt Disney animator. I went to college for animation and illustration. I wanted to be a cartoonist. That was the whole dream. And college didn't work out. It was one of those things where I was like, you know, I had one of those life-changing moments once I got to college. Because high school, you're kind of in that circuit of like, okay, we're all going to be successful artists and we're all going to do what we want to do. And then when you get to college, the world opens up and you're like, you know what? This is bullshit. I'm going to go and do something as opposed to being a slave working on a cartoon desk for Mickey Mouse for the rest of my life. So I went to makeup school as a goof. I went down to Orlando, went to a makeup school for 14 weeks and figured, hey, come back to New York, start working on some movies. I worked on a couple of trauma movies And then,
yeah, I love those.
Yeah. It's as bad as they look, believe me.
I love them. I don't care.
There's something about them, but they're just, it's a steep learning curve real mm-hmm. fast. You know, you're like, okay, this is how movies are made. Really? Then, you know, you slowly but surely you start making contacts and you work your way up the business. And I joined the makeup union about 13 years ago and have been doing it ever since.
And you've got a pretty extensive resume, but the one thing, I mean, outside of the fact that you touched Jennifer Lawrence's head or you saw her, which is really cool.
That's as far as it got.
I'm changing it up, right? I'm making it a little more special. Outside of that, I've got a little bit of a crush on her.
First thing that threw me about Jennifer Lawrence when I first met her, how tall she is.
Is she like 6 foot, something like that?
She's tall. Like, it threw me for a loop. Like, I'm about 5'7", so I'm short for a guy. But when I saw her, I was like, holy, she's tall. You know, you don't expect it. It's the last thing you would have thought of.
Is she genuine? Is it genuine
yes,
as she seems?
She's really nice. She's, as a person, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. She was very nice to me. We spoke briefly. Yeah, she was mad cool.
That's great. And the other thing is Spider-Man. I have to ask about Spider-Man. What is that like? Spider-Man's my all-time favorite character. Sorry, Red Reddington fans, but Spider-Man trumps all. What was that like working on the Spider-Man movies? I don't really care about the critical reception. I like those movies. Right. I genuinely like those movies. So what was that like? What was that whole process like for you?
Well, it was surreal because it was after doing all these indie films and low budget films and things like that, to be on like a Hollywood blockbuster type movie, mm-hmm. to see the stunts and just to see the scope of it all was mind blowing. The biggest thing for me was I worked under John Caglione Jr., who's famous for Dick Tracy and all that. And I worked for a number of makeup artists and they'd rebuilt Times Square for the second Spider-Man movie. They'd rebuilt Times Square somewhere in Long Island. And just to walk out there and see Times Square in the middle of a field and Jamie Foxx in the full Electro makeup and Spider-Man swinging from these cranes and being thrown and them flipping buses and cop cars like over and over and over was just like, it was unbelievable. I was speechless. Like I'd never seen anything like it in my life. You know, I'd actually seen a city bus get rolled over and they're like, cut, bring out another bus, cut, do it again, do it again, do it again. So we lost like four buses, but it was just fun. It was just so much fun to just be in that. Even if I didn't do one damn thing that day, even if I just touched up one background actor, just to be there in that vibe was just so surreal and so amazing.
Yeah, the big question is that people talk about special effects. And I had a friend who completely yelled at me for saying special effects. It's visual effects. It's not special effects.
He's absolutely right about that.
Is there one? Is it different? Is two different departments, or is it really just nomenclature change?
There's actually three departments. It's visual effects, which is the computer, CGI, anything like that. Backgrounds, painting in the, you know, cities, whatever. Special effects is actually practical when they do like rain, snow, squirting blood, anything like that. Squibs on the actors. That's all special effects. My thing is basically special makeup effects, which falls under prosthetics and monsters, whatever, wounds, things like that. So he's not that far off. There's three of them.
I knew the difference, Troy. Did you know the difference?
I knew there were two. I didn't know there were three. So the makeup is interesting because I thought the makeup would fall under the visual effects side of it. So that's pretty cool.
Do you know what a squib is, Troy? Do you know what a squib
is? Yeah, that's like the bullet thing. The
exploding bullet, yep. Anthony, for people that don't quite understand how that works, when you're doing makeup on an actor, how long is that process? Like, what's the process like for doing that?
Well, it really depends on the type of makeup I'm doing. If I can give you an example from The Blacklist, episode 401, Esteban, right? He had the eyes. He took out his eyes and did the clicking noises. The mm-hmm. blind guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for that.
Thank you.
Nightmares.
So something like that was a half hour process. Basically, I meet with the actor. I fit him with these prosthetic pieces. We glue them on. We color them in. We blend them. And he's good to go. And then I'm on set covering it all day. If I had to do something like an old age makeup or something more extensive, it could take upwards up to like 4 or 5 hours, depending on the length of makeup. If you're going to do something like from the X-Men movies, like Beast or Mystique or something like that, you're looking at half a day easily. But you also have a team of makeup artists coming in. So the scale and length of the makeup really hinges on the design itself. On the Blacklist, they don't give me that kind of luxury. I don't have hours to do a makeup. I pretty much have half hour or less. Anything over that, they look at me like, okay, how can we change it? Or how can we write this out? You know?
Mm-hmm.
The biggest one I remember, it was, I think it was 404. It was Gaia? Or was 403? It was 404. The one where it was the one where Aram wouldn't shoot the helicopter down, so Cooper did it.
Yep.
He had that son who had that really deformed face. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They showed it for like a minute. We had done this whole thing about makeup where we were going to do a practical and set it up. And I had designed this whole like lymph node, elephant man type thing. But unfortunately, the kid they had hired wasn't really ready to wear that kind of makeup. He was a young boy. He was not really seasoned, which I guess most kids aren't in the film industry, but he wasn't really ready to wear the makeup. So we ended up having to do it with computers instead. They scratched the makeup completely, but we had done numerous tests and we had gotten everything approved. And then finally it was like, you know what, the kid's just not going to wear it. So let's just do it with computers. So my job basically blends a lot with visual effects as well. Visual effects actually helped me with the Esteban makeup, where they actually took out his eye sockets. So my makeup covered his eyelids, but I can't remove his eyeball. So visual effects comes in and kind of scoops it out, if you will.
Magic.
Yeah, the VFX guys on Blacklist are amazing. They're really good. Brian Kupchevic, he's amazing. He does amazing work on that show. Out to see and everything like that, all the little effects he'll do. Most of the stuff that they do with the computers on that show, you'll never even see, but they're there.
So it is a partnership between you guys, because you would think that you classic people like you doing the makeup stuff are like, oh, computers are ruining the world, but you guys actually do team up, and in that case you're actually okay with it, because
absolutely I believe that the computers are not taking over the industry. We were all thinking that when Terminator 2 came out and Jurassic Park, we were all like, oh boy, this is it. We're done. No more big monster movies. And that's not, you know, that has happened. The monster movies are becoming more visual effects, which is like, look at the Wolfman movie. That was a perfect opportunity to do completely practical effects, Rick Baker and all that. But then they went and CGI'd the whole thing and it tanked. So it's one of those things where I believe the computer is just another tool in my arsenal, as opposed to being a complete replacement. You know, if you see the movie Species back in the day, mm-hmm. it's terrible because it's all CG. There's no makeup. So it kind of ruins it, you know, in a way. And the computer hasn't reached the level of creating what I call the soul of a human. If you look at a person in real life and you're wearing makeup, you can actually see the soul behind their eyes. There's a life in their eyes. Computers haven't replicated that yet.
Agreed.
They've done their best. Like if you watch like Tron Legacy or any of these movies now where they'll CGI the person younger or older or whatever, even in Westworld, they do that. But there's something about it that's slightly off, you know, just that little tiny bit that's slightly off. So it's a tool. It's not a complete replacement as of yet.
Let me ask you a question in terms of makeup itself. So when I was a little kid, my mom to desensitize me to a degree so I could watch horror movies and I could watch certain things. She really wanted to take the reality out of it, so to speak. So like Friday the 13th, those kind of movies, because I've always been an avid fan of horror movies, which I'm sure you've done plenty of monsters in your day.
I have. Definitely. And I'm a big fan of horror movies too.
Yeah. Simpatico. Well, what she did was she always made me watch like behind the scenes things, how makeup effects are done, how they're applied, how these people aren't really dead, da 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 da. Do you think, because now you work in this environment and you have for a very long time, does that take you out of it to a degree when you're watching a movie? Do you have a hard time watching a movie or a TV show without seeing the flaws or without seeing the makeup aspects?
If it's a good makeup, I don't notice it. The idea is that I don't notice the makeup. There are some movies just even recently where the makeup stands out so much you just can't not look at it. Now, to the average moviegoer, they're not seeing those edges or they're not seeing the color differentiation, but I automatically pick it up. So it does become a little bothersome sometimes where I'm watching a show and it's like, oh, what are they thinking? You know, and it's like, there's nothing you can do about it. You're like, and then I realized, like, even on The Blacklist, it happens where I get 15 minutes to do a makeup because of scheduling or the actor wasn't available. I don't get to do a life cast or make custom prosthetics. So I have to make a generic piece. Like, we just recently had an episode near the end where Samar comes in and grabs this guy by the cojones, and he has this whole burn on the side of his face. So that was not even planned. Like, let's just put a burn on him and we just throw it together. And it's like, okay, we got to do this real quick. And then when you watch the show, I see every single little flaw. But my wife, who's my litmus paper, she's like, nope, it looks fine. You're good. Everything's good. So it does become a hassle after a while. But sometimes I get, you know, I can watch a movie and be like, oh, you know what? Forget it. And if I watch it a couple of times, you know, you don't even notice it anymore.
Does your wife call you out when you get it wrong?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. She's a nurse. So every time I do a wound or any sort of illness, I run it by her first. And she'll be like, no, he's too pale. No, that's too yellow. No, it wouldn't bleed like that. So she's really good with that.
Oh, my God. My mom's a nurse. She does the exact same thing. True story.
Yeah, it's perfect. It's a great it's a great thing in my arsenal.
The follow-up from there would be, so you see these flaws and things of that nature. How much do you have to then work with maybe even direction or camera setup or scene setup to say, hey, you know what? We didn't quite get this. We didn't quite get that. So if you shoot this a certain way, you get any input on that to kind of cover up any imperfections because of the time crunch?
Well, the time crunch is the biggest factor for the entire cast and crew. We have 10 months to shoot 22 episodes and we shoot them every 9 days. So we are scrambling. And plus the scripts can come as quickly as the day before we start shooting. So thankfully our crew is one big family and the DPs like Saad Mustafa and Mike Caracciola, we get together and I'll be like, okay, listen, they'll set up the lights. They'll do everything. I bring the makeup out there. They will give me the luxury of saying, okay, I got to tweak this. I got to fix this. Our ADs are good. If I see a problem, one prosthetic stands out to me. It was 220 or 221. It was Quan Zhang. And it was this guy who was robbing graves with Asian statues and making like Asian brides and all this stuff. It was a really weird episode. But he had all these weird keloid scars all over the back of his head. And I remember chasing them every single day. And one day we were outside and it was bright sunlight right on top of him. I'm like, listen, is there anything we can do to kind of diffuse this? Because no matter what, if it's in bright sunlight, it's going to look like makeup. There's no way around it. You know, I don't want to have to go in with the VFX and tweak anything. Can we do it right now? And 9 times out of 10, they're pretty good. But that also that 1 time out of 10 where it's like, nope, there's no time. Let's go. Moving on. Don't sweat it so much. And you have to kind of pick your battles, you know. So if I see something that's off that only I see, I can live with it. But if I see something that people are like, hey, man, there's something wrong with that. We got to fix it. So it's kind of a never ending battle.
Wow. That's crazy. You got a great job.
I like to think so. It's fun. I mean, I enjoy it immensely. It's been very good to me. And I've met a lot of cool actors. Just being on The Blacklist alone, I've met most of my childhood actors. And it's been so much fun. Ron Perlman was one of my favorites when we did the Luther Braxton episodes back in season 2.
Oh, he seems like a great guy.
He was the coolest cat you ever met. And the funny thing is, it's like, immediately they were like, we want to put him in these scars and we want to put him in all this makeup. And I was like, listen, you know, Ron Perlman's kind of known for wearing a shitload of makeup. Mm-hmm. Everything he does, he wears makeup. How about in this one, we just change the color of his goatee and give him a tiny, tiny little scar on his cheek. That's it. Because he's so badass that no one could ever touch him. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That's how we were kind of thinking. And he was totally cool with it. He was all ready to be plastered up and all this burns and everything and half his hair shaved and everything. We're like, no, let's not make him a caricature. You know, we have Ron Perlman here. Let's use Ron Perlman. Yeah. So it's fun. There's so many cool actors we've had on the show so far. And I'm sorry when they die. I always miss, like, David Strathairn was the saddest one we ever had to kill. And he never gets to wear the blood and the gore and everything. So when he gets thrown out of the plane and smashed into the house in wherever it is, like Netherlands or something, We broke his neck and we broke his arm and blood all over. And he was ecstatic. He loved every minute of it, you know, but it was sad to see him go.
That's pretty awesome. So does that mean that you were you involved when they blew up? What was his name?
Alan Alda.
Alan Alda.
Yeah, I was. I mean, technically you never saw the head. So all it really was a special effects where they just fired blood against the glass. So there was no meat, there was no bone or like you just saw all that blood. So I was there, and funny thing about that, when the effects guys blasted the blood, it was in the orange box, you know, the famous orange box. Mm-hmm. So when they blasted it, James is standing on the other side of the glass. The force of the blood had kind of opened the door from the top, and the blood just rained down all over James.
Oh, no.
And believe me, his costume is very, very custom made. Yeah. So, you know, the wardrobe department had a field day with effects guys, but it was funny as hell. But, you know, James hates the blood. He comes next every time I have to put a drop on him, whenever it's, you know, the bruise or like little blood out of his ear. And then he looks at me with such disdain and he's just like, ugh. You represent everything that's wrong with this business, Anthony.
I could see. I mean, that is messy for a lot of actors. And I'm sure when you've probably been doing it as long as he has, you know, that kind of stuff becomes, I don't know what the word would be, but I could see that probably.
Totally. Totally. I mean, he does it. It's part of the job. He gets it, but he just doesn't like it, you know. But I have yet to actually put the burn scars on him again, the ones from season one. Like, we haven't done that at all.
Do you guys keep that? I assume because you have a mythology, so you have to keep certain things for long periods of time. Do you actually, like, have the scars basically held behind somewhere so that if you ever do need to reapply them, you have exactly where they go and what they look like?
No, no. All I have is the reference from the actual episode, from 122, whatever it was, the last episode. And I have photos of it from the season one, because I wasn't part of season one, so I don't have the actual materials or the actual products. I have to recreate it. So if they decide one day to show his back again, you know, I'm up to build a new set of burn scars that have to kind of look the same, but you know, no, the only people that are going to notice it are you guys, because no one's going to remember episode 122 and then something in season five. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I beg to differ.
There's a lot of people out there that'll remember.
True. But those are the people I have to worry about. John Q. Public, you know, the diehard fans, I kind of like have to say, hey, guys, listen, you know, we're busting our asses. So what we get out there is what we get out there. You know, he's got burns on his back. Here are the burns. Done. Mm-hmm. If they're not the exact same match of what you saw back in season one with the certain lighting and the way it was shot, you know, that was years ago already.
Yeah, you try to get it as close as you can.
The only thing I have saved so far is Leonard Call's missing fingers. Those I really love doing. Those were great. That guy was such a good guy. I had to tape his fingers to his palms. And since he's not dead, I keep anybody who's not dead, I keep their stuff just in case. Because Yabari, the guy from season two, the African guy, mm-hmm. he had the burned ear. So I learned my lesson, because in 201, that first scene when we first came back, Reddington's in the jungle and he blows up the compound and everything like that. He's got the burned ear. And I'm like, okay, good. He's done. It's over. Then, of course, we come to the Earl King episode with the auction, and there's Yabari again. Well, shit, I already threw away the ear. So I learned my lesson, you know, keep everything until they're actually dead on the show.
That's crazy.
I guess that's the big question. Is there like documentation? Do you have to take pictures, write down certain?
Yeah, we have what's called
compound or that compound.
Absolutely. We have what's called continuity. And I have reams of photos and books and everything of like, okay, this is what he looked like. This is what wrestler looked like today. Wrestler gets back in season two, we were beating him up every other episode. A bruise here, blood here, scratch here. So I was going, okay, he's got a bruise here. He's got it for 3 days. He's got to carry this through. Timelines of the injuries. The biggest one we had was season two again. Wrestler 206. It was the Mombasa was it the Columbasa cartel? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. With the taxidermy in the woods and the guy who played Lurch. You know, it was the weird one with the mom and the guy in the tub and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Soapy Giant episode. Yeah.
Giant episode. Yes. Wrestler gets tagged in the ear with a tag. So now, me being a realist, I'm like, okay, well, if we tag him, that means he's got a puncture in his ear. That means in episode 207, he's got to have some sort of injury remarking from the last episode, because the show technically doesn't, it has no real timeline. You guys have talked about that. There is no real timeline. Okay, this is the next day, or this is the next week, or this is a month from now. You know, it doesn't say that. So there are certain episodes where, like, okay, we're playing this as if they literally got back to the war room, okay, now you're off to do another gig. You know what I mean? So it's like back and forth. Or sometimes it's like, oh, it's months ahead. Like, baby Agnes grew up so fast. You know, it's like, so we have to kind of keep the continuity and the timeline of the injuries or the makeups throughout the whole show. And I still have the stuff from season 2 and season 3 and season 4.
One important, you brought up wrestler, and it's very important. Tori Melchin, if you're listening, and this is for you. Are you the person in charge of making sure his hair never moves? Or is that you?
I've heard you guys talk about this a million times, and I laugh every single time. There is a hair department head.
Like, so just for his hair? Just for Diego?
No, there is a hair person. Vanessa Sims does the hair for the show, so she's in charge of everybody's hair. I'm in charge of everybody's face. I am in charge of face, hands, anything skin. Anything hair is the hair department. And Diego pretty much has his own style. The hair department, they cut him, he styles it himself, and you're right, it never moves.
It doesn't.
It absolutely never moves. But it's a good look. It works for him.
No, hey, he's a handsome fella.
You should see when he comes in the morning before he goes to the works. I mean, he looks a lot different. In the sense, his hair's all shaggy and everything. So the sculpted wrestler look is definitely a character choice.
Well, it's delightful. I mean, really, it's very impressive. The guy can be running against a hydraulic engine, and I still don't think his hair would move. He could be caught in a jet stream, and his hair is still like, I got this.
Yeah, I remember the episode where we had him dragging on a – it was the one with the kids in the woods, the Kenyon family from season 2. And the dirty boys and with the lost boys in the woods.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And wrestler gets captured and he's dragged behind an ATV vehicle. And I had to like mess him up and dirt and everything like that. And I'm like, should we mess up your hair? And he goes, do we have to? I'm like, no. All right, let's move on.
That's fantastic.
That's awesome.
Well, I'm just curious, like, what's the hardest thing you've had to do for the show? I mean, you had Kaplan this season with the whole getting shot in the face / head. Is that the hardest, or has there been something harder?
Technique-wise, that wasn't hard. The hardest part about Kaplan was the decision. The thing is, like, I don't get the arc. I get the scripts. So I don't know what's happening the next episode down the line. Once in a while, the producers will be like, okay, listen, this is what's happening 3 episodes from now. So you got to kind of get this ready. Get this started now. But I don't know where it's ending. So when I read that Susan or Kaplan is getting shot in the head, in the face, where is she getting shot, guys? Because now it comes down to what am I going to do when it comes to a practical standpoint? They say all it said in the script was Reddington shoots her in the face. I'm like, okay, where in the face, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, well, let's do something on the side of her head. And she has a metal plate in her head and it ricochets and goes through her cheek. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, where the fuck did she get a metal plate in her head? And I don't know until much later, you know, when I actually read the script, I'm like, oh, that makes sense now. The Johns are like that. John Bokenkamp and Eisendrath, where they know all the secrets, but they only divvy out a little bit of information at a time. It's a need to know basis, which makes my job hard, because now I'm thinking, okay, if I'm going to put a bullet through this woman's cheek, is it going to heal? Where is it going to heal? She's out in the woods. How is it healing? What is the hunter using to make it heal? And the biggest thing is, like, if Kaplan is going to play on for the rest of the show or the rest of the season, possibly into season 5, season 6, season 7, whatever, what is now there? Is there a scar? Is there some sort of like bullet wound? What are we actually seeing? And no real decisions could get made. I had to come up with a bunch of different drafts for them. I actually gave them four different versions of Kaplan with varying degrees of injury, where she was shot and how it affected her face. Like, we had one design where half of her cheek was her cheek was completely blown out. So it was like, it would be all very similar to Gary Oldman in Hannibal, where, remember, where he was like, yeah, all screwed up in the face, like just skin grafts and everything like that. Mm-hmm. But then we'd have to explain, where did these skin grafts come from? We know the hunter didn't do it, you know? So it's like, what, he'd take a piece of skin off of her ass and stick it to her face? Like, we don't know. So there's no real science where these wounds are coming from. I always use the same excuse for Diego. It's like, Diego and Megan have been beaten up so many times on this show that literally their faces would be a mass of scars at this point, you know, but we can't do that. So suspension of disbelief has to come into play when it comes to injuries on television. You know, in a film, you can do it. You have 2 hours to tell your story. You can go from point A to point B. Mm-hmm. On television, by next week, they got to be cleaned up, ready to go for the next episode. You can't start carrying over injuries from the previous episode, because then the people who just join in are going to like, what the hell happened to his head? Mm-hmm. You know, did I miss something? And that's going to screw people up. So in our world, in the Blacklist world, and most television shows, injuries heal very fast. They have some of the best doctors. That's our excuse. They have the best doctors, best plastic surgeons, and we can get through it. But going back to Kaplan, we finally – and Susan was great. She worked with me on this because Susan doesn't want to wear a shitload of makeup. She doesn't want to be made into look like a monster. And I had shown her the drafts, and some she was happy with, some she felt that were like a little over the top. And one thing about this show, we're not trying to make it over the top in the sense that when you watch it, Susan gave such a beautiful performance. I don't want you to be staring at her cheek the whole time. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So we basically came down to it once she was patched up and hiking, you know, doing the Incredible Hulk, the Bruce Banner walk down the highway thing. We had decided that she was just going to have a very diminutive scar that would show that there was something there. And then her hair would cover it the whole time. Now, as far as the hair piece, the thing that showed the wound on the back of her head, that was an afterthought. What I had originally proposed and was a go was that Kaplan, being such a practical person, when she had got shot the first time by the guy who broke into the pawn shop when she was with her girlfriend back mm-hmm. in the past,
mm-hmm.
When she got shot in the head and she's in surgery and she wakes up and she's crying and everything like that, we had decided that Kaplan would shave her head bald, because if she's going to take care of this wound, it seems impractical to have all this hair around it. You know, you'd want to keep it short and tight and cover it. And then we can introduce the Kaplan that we know today, Susan Blomart's character, wearing a wig. So when she reveals to the cop, I hope I'm not losing you guys. I know you guys are fans, so I'm just talking.
Absolutely.
Straight up. Okay. So when she's in the trailer and the cop knocks on the door and says, hey, what are you doing here? Blah, blah. She's supposed to pull off her entire wig and she'll be bald with a wound. You know what I mean?
Oh.
And that would have been like a holy shit moment, you know?
Yeah.
We had no idea it was a wig all that time. And it was a good go for a while. There's actually footage of it where we had shot it, but then they had decided to change it and go just to this hair piece bit where she pulls off a chunk of hair and there's the wound there. So, but that's basically, you know, how a decision it was the whole season I spent figuring out how we were going to do Kaplan's makeup. It was such a pain in the ass, but it got done and it looked great and we were all happy with it.
I think it actually might play better this way because I don't know. I feel like it would play better this way because that might be too dramatic a change, maybe.
True. Very true. I mean, it's the same reason why Reddington keeps his hair very short, because James had said that, because James has long hair. You know, if you've seen him in The Office, mm-hmm. his hair grows. Like, he comes in every beginning of the season, full head of hair, and they shave him down. But James had said that Reddington wouldn't have the time to go get haircuts. You know, Dembe is not cutting his hair. So the easiest thing to do is just take a buzzer and clip it. So I had figured, like, maybe Kaplan would do the same thing because she's such a practical person, too. why would she mess around with this ointment on her head and trying to, you know, heal her wound, as opposed to like what any doctor would do with a head wound where they would shave you.
So that's his character choice, I guess. I don't know why. I just always assume it's a question I never asked anyone or looked up or anything, but I guess I always assumed that the reason is just because he's aging, and most actors, you know, it just seemed like a more sensible choice.
Redding, James has a great head of hair. So it was one of those things where it's like Reddington wouldn't have the time. James is very, very meticulous about the characters, mm-hmm. you know, down to what color handkerchief he has. Like everything you see with Reddington on camera is the writers and James making every single decision, you know, and it's perfect because James sells it every time. So same thing like the hair, you know, he buzzes his hair because Reddington, why would Reddington get a haircut, you know?
That's a pretty.
He's always moving around.
It's a pretty strong choice for an actor, though. You know, because many actors, I mean, their looks are somewhat part of the sale for them, career wise. You know, so that's actually taking vanity out of it to a degree. And
James, I wouldn't say is a vain person.
No,
James
he didn't seem
one of those people. Like, if you look at any of his projects, it's not about what he looks like; it's about his performance. So, I mean. It would never be a situation like I remember in Boston Legal, he'd like be in drag or be in a flamingo costume, or in Lincoln, he'd be under all this fake hair, or in Stargate or whatever. So the look of the character, every actor on our show has a definitive say on what their look is, like Megan's scar on her wrist, mm-hmm. Samar's look, you know, Cooper, everything like that. They all have an idea of what their character should look like. And it's up to me to work with it and make it a reality. You know, and James is very meticulous about it.
God, Stargate. If you really want to see a contrast in performances, that's a good watch Blacklist and then go watch Stargate. It's like polar opposite.
And then you could polish it off with Mannequin.
I love Mannequin. Hey,
I love Mannequin.
Mannequin's great.
I love Mannequin. And let me tell you, the day Andrew McCarthy came to set to direct the first time, I had a moment, I geeked out moment where I'd seen both of them together and I was like, it's Mannequin right there in front of me.
And Less Than Zero. I mean, so it's like all the way across the board. I keep telling.
See, When I was a kid. So Less Than Zero was out of my way. Like I was out of my wheelhouse. I was growing up on Mannequin and Pretty in Pink. So I was like, I never saw Less Than Zero until I was older. So I didn't grow up with it as much. But it was cool just to see them both together in the same room. Like, oh my God, you know, geek out moment.
That was actually pretty cool because there, my grandfather, stupid story, but my grandfather took me to see Platoon 10 minutes in, 15 minutes in. My grandpa says, no, we're not watching this because, you know, it's F-bomb.
Right.
And so we leave the theater and he's like, we're going to see something else. And I'm just depressed because I want to see Platoon. And so what else is playing? Mannequin had just come out because Platoon was playing. It was Oscar season, I think, if I remember right. It was one of the first times I ever saw James Spader in a movie. And so we went and saw Mannequin and fell in love with Kim Cattrall and Andrew McCarthy and James Spader. It's a weird coincidence. Platoon led me to James Spader.
But Platoon is more of a, like, I think Mannequin is more of an adult movie than Platoon.
Well,
there's a lot of language. Sex jokes in Mannequin.
Yeah, it was the language. My grandpa's not a fan of language, of any any kind of language. And so there was a lot of those kinds of movies that Spader did that I really got hooked on. He was also, the New Kids, I think was the name of it. That was a really, like, low-budget, really cool movie that he did that I always thought was really fun. He was a fun actor in the 80s. Yeah, you should go find him. I remember it because Friday the 13th director was involved. Sean Cunningham was the director.
And, Sean Conn, okay.
Yeah, and he was, I don't remember what he played. I think he was the villain, if I remember right. But
well, he seems like he always played the villain.
In the 80s, he definitely, yeah, he got stuck in that.
Totally.
It was Sean Cunningham. It was Lori Loughlin was in that, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The New Kids?
Yep.
Wow, yeah. Lori Loughlin. I haven't heard that name in ages.
Yeah. She was in Secret Admirer, right, with Kelly Preston. Yep. Oh, boy. Now I'm getting off track. All right. Sorry.
We tend to do that.
We do.
Movie buffs tend to do that.
We do. So what's the hardest thing you ever had to make?
The hardest thing I've ever had to do.
Or do, yeah. Or if, I'm sorry, you talked about Blacklist, but I mean overall. Like
overall.
All the projects you've had to do.
I don't know. That's kind of a loaded question. I got to think about that for a second because there are some jobs where it was mostly like a time factor where I was out of time or some jobs where the makeup didn't work right. I remember a lotto. I did a New York Lotto commercial once where this guy's playing a prank on his friend, where all these aliens come invading New York City, all these white giant aliens. Mm-hmm. And we'd walked, it was 30 makeup artists. And for some reason I went in to do the job, but all of a sudden I got hired. I was elevated to the status of leading the troops. And I was like, okay, I got to teach all these makeup artists, because all the makeup artists they had hired were not effects makeup artists. So they had no idea how to make alien makeups. So we had 30 bodybuilders, and we just had to like ghetto rig this whole setup of white masks and white body paint and silicone and black eyes and all these things like that, just to kind of make them look somewhat like an alien. It was a hard job because it was a mad dash scramble, and we only had one day to shoot it, and it was near the beginning of spring, so the sun was still going down early. It was just, I remember it being a madcap dash of like, everybody get makeup on, I don't care what it looks like, just go, 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 go. And then at the end of the day, we had found out that these bodybuilders had all this peach fuzz on their chests and their back. So the makeup we had put on them had actually stuck to the hair. Mm. So we had to sit there for hours with tiny, tiny little scissors and razors and slice off all the hair because you couldn't pull it off. It's what you call a mechanical lock. When hair gets embedded in silicone, it locks. It does not come out. So you have to kind of like either rip off the hair or cut it off. So it was a hard job. I remember that being a hard job.
Oh man, that sounds awful.
It was pretty awful. I mean, in the payoff is kind of like, you know, you see the commercial. I know the commercial's on my website, and it's like, it's cute, you know, it's 30 second spot for Lotto, but it was a nightmare. It was an absolute nightmare to shoot.
Do you ever get actors that, and please don't name names because we're not that kind of show. But do you ever get actors through the course of what you do that? Because I keep thinking about it, and when you're in like a latex mask or something for a long period of time and you're letting it sit and you're letting it take form or mold, I assume it can be very claustrophobic. Do you ever have actors who just can't do it? It's too
absolutely
difficult?
Absolutely. I've had actors completely freak out, and they won't do it. They don't care. Their agents get involved. The production gets involved. They just won't do it. And you can't really tell some – I've had some A-listers be like, absolutely not. You know, you're not doing that. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, whatever you want. I'm not here to fight you. I'm telling you what I was hired to do. This is above my pay grade. I'm here to do the job, but I'm not here to tell you to do the job. You know what I mean?
Right.
So it's one of those situations where you feel like an ass because you're standing there with all this stuff that they hate you and they hate the stuff you brought. And it's just like, I just work here, guys. I don't know what to tell you. You guys should have had a meeting, maybe. So it's unfortunate. It happens sometimes when production, because I believe production is a completely different beast as opposed to the crew. Mm-hmm. And production, they'll spring stuff on actors like, oh, by the way, we're cutting off your arm today. Are you cool with that? Or we're going to spray your hair white. Are you cool with that? Or we're going to glue your lips to the outside and you won't be able to blink for 3 hours. But, you know, it's going to look great. It's going to look great. And then they look at me like, what exactly are you doing to me? I'm like, I'm just going to take some tape and, you know, it's like, eh. So it's unfortunate when that happens. And it tends to happen sometimes where, you know, on any show where you'll have a bunch of extras. Say like if I have, a perfect example. In The Blacklist, the episode, see now this one I don't remember. Okay, it was the Romeo and Juliet episode where the girl, the blonde girl, was in love with the black guy who was the doctor. Everything she touched died instantly.
Natalie Luca.
Man, you're good. Natalie Luca. We had a shot of all these dead bodies when she's a little girl. She's escaping the hospital. We had all these dead bodies all over the hospital. You only saw like two, but we had all these dead bodies in the hospital. I had 10 people all made up, but none of those people knew that I was putting makeup on them when they came to work that day. They were just showing up.
Oh, wow.
So it was like, oh, shit, we're going to put all this stuff on you. We're going to put this foam out of your mouth and blood out of your eyes. And they get – some people are into it, you know. But then some people, like this one woman came in completely made up, dressed to the nines, ready to be on camera. And we're like, no, you're playing a dead body, honey. We're just going to throw you on the ground. We're going to put blood on you. You're going to put foam in your mouth and you just be there dead. And, you know, you could sense that they're pissed off. Mm-hmm. But, hey, you know, it's Hollywood. You gotta roll with the punches.
That's great. Know?
Those things make the day hard, you know, because I try to appease everybody. My job is 80% psychological, 20% actual makeup. You have to trust me to touch your face, where in most societies, you don't go around touching people's faces. You know, you'll shake their hand and that's it. But I got to get up in there. You know, I'm on the nose. I'm cleaning out the hair in your ears. I have to make sure there's nothing in your teeth. I'm right in your face. So there has to be a trust level. And if or automatically the actor comes in and they're like pissed because, oh, they didn't tell me I was wearing all this makeup today, automatically I'm the bad guy. So now I have to kind of, what was an easy job now became a hard job, because now I have to convince this actor, I'm here to protect you. I'm here to make it easy for you. It sucks that they didn't tell you, but hey, man, let's have some fun with it, mm-hmm. you know? And if you don't, then they'll just hire someone else. What are you going to do?
And how often do you work with like Megan and Diego and the other cast? Because I would think most of your job would be guest stars and supporting characters, because they're usually the ones getting shot or hurt.
Oh, no, no. I'm the makeup department head, so I'm in charge of everybody.
Oh, wow.
I delegate. I have a wonderful key. I have a key makeup who is my right hand. Her name is Stephanie Wise. She is my rock. She takes care of all the stuff that I can't take care of, because I'm doing the stuff with the meetings. While we're shooting an episode, I already have the script for the next episode. So I'm already planning ahead while we're shooting the one that's playing. And I have two other great makeup artists, Amy Watford and Shannon Dollison. Shannon is delegated to Megan. Stephanie, my key, is delegated to James. I deal with everybody else. And we all switch around. Like if my key makeup Stephanie is ill that day, I do James, or you know, someone else can do Megan. But I've trained my team to do every one of our main characters. We have a 9 principal cast, from you know, Spader all the way down to Susan and Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and now that Ryan's back on the show, it's like we just add another character back in. You know what I mean? So it's all these things that I have to delegate who does what, how everybody's makeup looks. When it comes to the effects makeup, when there's blood or a bruise or anything like that, 9 times out of 10, I'll do it. But we shoot a tandem every 8 days. So that means the last 2 days of episode 1, we're already shooting episode 2. And then the last 2 days of episode 2, we're shooting episode 3. So I have to split my team in half every 8 days. So I have to delegate. Okay, today Spader gets some blood on the side of his head from a car crash. So Stephanie, you're going to do that. I'm going to be on the other episode doing the burn makeup on this guy. And then you're going to do some more. And then I'm going to do this. And I'm going to do Diego, Cooper, and Amir. You got this. And then when we have the guest stars come in, 9 times out of 10, they're perfect. They're great. I usually do the guest stars because I geek out. Most of my team, they're younger. So, like, they don't know who Ron Perlman is, or they don't know who Tony Shalhoub. Or,
shame on them if they don't know who Shalhoub is.
You know what killed me? They didn't even know who Fisher Stevens was.
What?
Come on. Here's the best one. We had Brent Spiner. I'm not a Star Trek fan. Never was. Probably never will be. Everybody on set was freaking out, loving it. Oh, my God. Brent Spiner. Oh, my God. I was like, hey, how you doing? I did his makeup. I did the little tattoo on the side of his neck. Cool guy. But I was the only guy who didn't geek out. So I think he and I bonded. We got along pretty well. So 9 times out of 10, when we have a guest star and I know who it is immediately, I'm like, oh, my God, do you see who we're getting? Who's coming in? And they're like, who's that? I'm like, you know what? You're all dead to me. I can't talk to you right now. Like Fisher Stevens, did nobody see Short Circuit or My Science Project, or am I just living in the past? I don't get it.
Some people don't deserve to be in entertainment. There's just
it happens more often than you think.
I don't doubt it. There's been so many great actors on there. I mean, Lance Henriksen, freaking Lance. Oh, Lance!
You know what? Here's the best story about Lance. Lance was so cool. Everybody was geeking out. They were talking about aliens or Near Dark or whatever. I said, listen, I'm only going to ask you one question about aliens, and that's all I'm going to ask you. He's like, all right, you better make it a good one. I'm like, I got to know. When Bishop was crawling through that little tiny tube to get to the satellite tower, how long were you in that tube? He's like, dude, I was in that tube for 5 hours. and that thing was half a mile long. And he did it for real, back and forth.
Did he really?
Yeah, I had no idea. I thought it was just like a cool camera shot. Maybe he said no. He was crawling in that tube nonstop.
Oh wow, that's insane!
Yeah. Impressive. It's those little stories that I love to hear from an actor, because I try not to geek out because it's unprofessional. You don't want to be like we had Paul Rubens. I mean, it's Pee Wee Herman. You don't meet Pee Wee Herman in normal situations, even in the film industry. But such a nice guy. Mm-hmm. Like, we had such a good time. We had known a lot of the same people. We were talking about the movies, talking about the Pee, because I grew up on Pee Wee's Playhouse. I asked him, I remember saying to them, like, how did you get your hair to spike up like that? Because one time for Halloween, I wanted to dress up like Pee Wee Herman, but I couldn't get my hair to do that. He goes, oh, that was glued on. That was a hairpiece glued on. And I'm like, really? He goes, yeah. Sorry to burst your bubble. I was like, what? Are you kidding me?
That's fantastic.
So it's like, oh, these little stories that you hear from the actors when you're one-on-one person with them. That's one of the benefits of my job. That's what I think I love about my job. Is that I get to meet such as cool people. You know, there's some really cool people in this industry. You know, I did an episode of Law & Order SVU where I got to work with Mike Tyson. And Mike Tyson is an enigma. He's a great guy, but it's just such a mystery about him. Like, you know, you hear all these things about, you know, Mike Tyson. Mm-hmm. But you don't know Mike Tyson. He's actually sitting in front of you, you know, and you're putting makeup on him. And then by the end of it, we became best friends. I got him to sign my copy of Mike Tyson's Punch-Out for my Nintendo.
You're kidding me.
Nope,
that's cool.
Got it framed and everything. Actual cartridge.
That's fantastic. Oh, that's fantastic. Signed your Mike Tyson Punch-Out game.
Totally.
Oh, man.
Well, how about some fan questions? Let's throw these out there at you. Most recently, Anita comes up with the bees, the bee lady. How much did you have involvement with the bees, and how did that all work?
Okay, the bee lady is I did the burn scars. There's this shot after the bees all leave her. She smokes them off. She's all scarred from her neck all the way down to her waist. I had actually covered the actress's breasts with the prosthetics and everything, and we had a full set of prosthetics. But being network television, you can't really show any kind of breasts, let alone one that's even covered up. There was no nipple or anything. But I had designed a whole set of prosthetics, and I had worked with the beekeepers and the VFX department, because we actually had real bees on set. And on top of that, they had done VFX bees for when they were on top of the actress. There's, if you watch the episode, there's shots of the bees that are real, and then there's shots that are just computer-generated bees. So it was a crazy day. I'll tell you that much. It was a crazy day. We had a lot of bees.
I'm phobic, so I would have quit.
Yeah, we were ready to quit. And I'm not even scared of bees, but we were all just like, this is insane. And, you know, you kind of like, who, you know, the writers come up with it and we try to make it a reality. But sometimes you just got to be like, there's too many bees in set right now. There's just too many bees. I think they had like 2,500 bees.
I was telling Troy, I've been stung like over 100 times when I was a kid. It was real bad. Had a couple bad runs. So just hearing the noise, it like literally triggers something. I couldn't imagine being around that much.
There was a definitive hum on set because we shot that in our soundstage. We didn't go to location. That was an actual set. They built that whole cabin thing. The hum of the bees was very unnerving. You know, because you're waiting at any minute for those things to just come out and take us all out, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I firmly believe, like, people say you don't want to be against the bees extinction because then the planet would die. But I think I'm okay with it. I'll be honest with you. I'll be all right.
No, we need the bees, but just not on film. We can CGI them now. That's where, you know.
I said that to John and he's just like, oh, but it seemed better or something like that. When you remember that, Troy?
John was in L.A. He wasn't there.
That's funny. Mary Beth wants to know, how authentic do you make the visuals to match the script? Say, for example, if it is supposed to be, what does it say, adult bones in the briefcase, do you make adult-sized bones? I think somebody's trying to get a clue.
The bones in the briefcase?
Yeah.
I don't do that. That's actually the props department. So as far as like any kind of prop like that, skeletons and corpses and stuff, that's all them.
I keep the realism. I keep as close to the script as possible. If they say there's a scar over his right eye, or the guy removes his eyeballs or something like that, or the Kenyon family, when they say, okay, and the twigs are sticking out of his eyes, I'm like, okay, that's what we're doing. Twigs out of his eyes. I'm not there to recreate the wheel. I am the writer's paintbrush. They come up with it. I make it happen. I put my flair into it, and I will give them suggestions on what could work better, but I don't redesign anything to suit my own needs. I will tell them, like, listen, this is possible or this is not possible. But as far as realism goes, as I said, my wife's a nurse, so when it comes to any sort of injury or any sort of scarification, I'm on it 100%. Tattoos as well. Any person that has a tattoo on that show, I do all the research behind it. Like, this guy's a Aryan white supremacist, like the one that was let go of prison. I forget what the episode was, but they had let the guy, he was all tattoos. And I had researched hundreds of like Nazi tattoos and German tattoos and evil, like, you know, it was awful. My wife looked at me like, the FBI is going to come after you when they see what's on your computer. But, you know, I have to do all the research on this. So I try to keep the realism as close as possible.
That's great.
The Architect with Brent Spiner.
The Architect. Yes, that was the episode where they get the guy out of the prison. See, you're so good at that. And I was there, man. But it's like they become a blur after a while, you know?
He's a robot. He really is a robot.
Store it all in the database. Oldie but a goodie. Now, you weren't there in season one, but how would you have done this effect? Because the Milton Bobbitt episode where he's drinking his mushroom shake underneath the UV lights.
He pulls
lights,
his nose off.
Pulls off his nose. How does... That's that combination of you have to do some of that, and obviously the VFX have to do a part of that. How does that walk us through that kind of process for that one?
How would I have done that? Now, actually, a friend of mine actually did that makeup. My friend Jeremy Sellenfriend, he does makeup in New York as well, and he worked on season one. So I know he did the makeup. How would I? I know they combined VFX with it, but it would have been very similar to, like, obviously, I would have made the fake nose, the piece that comes off. And then what's left is the socket. I would have made the edging of the socket of where the nose would be. And it would be like a raised prosthetic. And then they go in and just remove the rest with VFX. What I like to do is give VFX a little something more to work off of. So I would have designed an actual cavity, but it's kind of hard to explain, but it's sort of like reverse imaging. If you look at your nose right now, and I actually painted the tip of your nose black and kind of like put all this gore and gunk and whatnot on there. If you shoot it from a certain angle, instead of it coming outward, it'll look like it's going inward. And it's sort of like a trick, an optical illusion, if you will. So I would have to like kind of paint it and edge it so it looks like, instead of like, if you look at it from the profile, it's a giveaway. You see the nose. But if you look at it almost dead on from a certain angle, I can make it look like that it's actually going inward, you know, and then the VFX guys can go in and fix up the rest. We did an episode like that, the Vem, where the child molester priests they killed the clown, and they put the hot lead down their throat and everything. So we had to do these whole effects where the lead had burned through their cheeks and through their neck, and the guy's on fire, his stomach's on fire. So we had to do all these effects where I would paint it so it looked like deeper than it really was. And then VFX can go in and scoop out even more, you know? So that's probably how I'd have done Milton Bobbitt. It was relatively, you know, it wasn't too much of a hard idea. It was a good idea. I thought it was a really great episode. I love some of the stuff from season one. They did some great episodes.
That's cool.
Sure did. Do you have to green screen any of that sometimes? Did you paint green specifically?
No, haven't had to do that yet. The VFX guys, the technology has changed now where you don't have to really paint green on anything. All I have to do is put tracking dots. So I would actually paint like little tiny white circles on the face, and then they go in and create something completely new. You know?
That's interesting.
Because if we shoot green screen, like, A, we'd have to have the green screen behind them, which is a whole nother hassle. You know, you got grips, electric, lighting, camera, all that. But if they go in with just tracking marks, then the VFX guys have all the tools they need now. The technology is incredible what they can do.
Rob wants to know, are there things that you would like to do but cannot because of, you know, budget constraints and that sort of thing? If so, name one or two of them that you would like to do.
On the blacklist? Oh, You know what? Someone asked me this question years ago. And okay, it's not so much the budget. The budget is pretty good when it comes to me, because if they write it, then I got to make it happen. Simple as that. Mm-hmm. But it's the time constraint is always the problem, because if we get the script and then we're shooting this effect 2 days later, it's just impossible to actually make something from scratch in 2 days, depending on what it is. But if I wanted to do something for this show, what I would really like to do, well, I'll give you two. One of them is I want to do some sort of like a, see, we've done outbreaks before, like an outbreak, and they kind of like, we did the one with the front back in season two. And the idea is that there was this scope of half the world is in an outbreak. Oh my God, everybody's going and going and going. But they didn't really convey that, because you can't. It's a television show. You only have a certain, you only have 44 minutes to tell the story. But I want to do a scene where I have at least 100 background in some really messed up outbreak type sickness makeup. Everybody's vomiting and pustules, just a complete horror show. Sort of like, I want to bring back the Halloween episode, you know? Mm-hmm. Roseanne used to do it the best. They don't do Halloween episodes that much anymore.
Hallelujah.
I want Halloween episode. And we aired during October. I like to think that the Mombasa Cartel was our Halloween episode, because it was the one that aired right before Halloween. But then that was it. We don't have that anymore. So I want a Halloween episode. I want something that's completely nightmarish, or a hallucinating dream sequence that's really in depth, you know, with like goblins and monsters and zombies and whatnot. The closest thing we ever get to that are like illnesses, but we don't get anything really graphic. Something fun like that, you know?
Really, the closest you probably would have gotten would have been Frederick Barnes in season one, where he goes into the courtroom and then locks everybody in there with the, right. the canisters.
But right, you don't but that's get to all, see any of it, veins. Right? Yeah, but see, that's all just veins and stuff, because that's a time constraint. So you can't really get into the meat. You can't make a Walking Dead episode in 2 days, you know? And ideally, I would like to have an episode like that. The other thing I would really like to do is do sort of like a, it's not really like a Benjamin Button type thing, but someone where like an accelerated aging makeup where someone's like really falling apart, you know, like all of a sudden they get older and older and older, like a genetic disorder or something like that. I think that would be a lot of fun to do, because it's something that could show a real scope of makeup. But of course, time constraints, that's what it all comes down to. Like we had an episode. Oh, my God. That one, I don't even remember the name, but it was the one, the guy sitting in a chair. And they're doing these tests on him, but he's dying, and he starts bubbling and pustules and everything like that. And it was on a ship. See, we've had so many people who are sick on the show. So
that would have been Adrian Shaw, part one.
Jeez, Adrian Shaw. Yeah, the doctor. You're absolutely right.
How do you know that, you freak?
See, all I got to do is give you one clue, and boom, you got it.
How do you know that? Okay, it's insane.
I'll just to further elaborate on that question, one episode I really liked doing was the Crispin Crandall one with all the frozen bodies.
Yeah.
Because the kicker is we had done 20 frozen bodies, but you only saw two, you know, because of time constraints. It's what they shot. It's what they show. Mm-hmm. The guy getting his thumb cut off and all that stuff. So, like, I like doing big scope, huge background type gigs where I can hire a bunch of my friends and we all come in and just sling makeup and everybody gets done. But, you know, you got to work with what you got. So it's not so much a budget constraint as it is time constraints.
Gotcha.
Marilyn here said, what do they use for blood, and how do you make it ooze on command?
What do we use for blood? We use all different types of blood, theatrical blood. You can purchase it. We don't make blood because it's so much easier to just buy it. But blood usually consists of things like Karo syrup, dish soap, food dye, and whatnot. As far as it oozing on command, it really depends on the shot. Okay, for example, Cooper, when he thought he was dying, and I had to make his nose bleed. So something as subtle as that was a very intricate makeup, because I'm sitting there with a giant turkey baster type syringe, and I'm right behind Harry Lennox, and they roll cameras. Everybody's ready to go. The cameras are rolling. I roll up. I squirt a little bit right inside his nose, and then I run off set, run off camera, roll camera. The blood starts leaking out his nose. He wipes it. He crashes down to the ground. Cut, clean it up, start over, do it again. So oozing on command is pretty much me standing right behind camera, ready to go with a syringe, run in, squirt it, and get out. And as it's dripping, I get out. Gaia, same thing. He pulled these giant cotton things out of his nose at the beginning. He's living in the bus.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And so we called this. He really did. That actor really shoved all that cotton up his nose. He really, like, we, I don't know how, but he was like, because we were like, we can cut it, we can make it short. He's like, no, man, I'm going to do it. I'm like, you're going to do it? He's like, yeah. He's like, all right, go for it, man. Knock yourself out. He did it, man. He put it all the way up. And I couldn't even believe it. But I had to sit there and drop blood on the leaves and like little shots like that. It's usually 9 times out of 10, me running in, squirting a little blood. Or if it's more elaborate, the special effects guys will come in with blood tubing and they'll run tubes and they'll squirt blood out of weed sprayers and air compressors and whatnot. They do all the bullet hits on the show. So anytime someone gets shot, that's all them, you know, getting shot in the arm, getting shot, all the gunshots in the show.
That's pretty cool.
It's crazy. It's a crazy day.
But really, I'm going to read this exactly as Troy wants me to read it. My God, man. But really, the most important question comes from Linda. How hard is it to transform red into a man every single week?
Oh, my God.
Bum, ba-dum, bum,
that was Linda's question, by the way.
Yeah, but...
How hard is it to transform Reddington into a man?
Yeah, because he's technically, you know, Katarina.
I don't see...
Such a
Katarina,
dip.
I think Katarina's in the water, man. I can't say what I think per se because I don't know. Like I have all my theories are based off what you guys have said because you guys have brought things to light that I never even considered. I'm like, oh my God, that's right. That makes sense. Because unfortunately, even though I'm actually part of the team, I don't remember the episodes as far back as you guys do. So when you say something like, well, you know, Katarina did this in this episode, I'm like, holy shit, he's right. I didn't even think of that. And then I'll actually go back and watch it and be like, oh, wow. So maybe he is the mom. Maybe he's not the mom. I think it's still a toss up, you know. But as far as the question, I mean, you know, Reddington comes in ready to go. I'll leave it at that.
Because he's already a man, baby. Yeah,
He comes in ready for camera. He walks in, he's ready to go.
My important question is, since you worked on the Amazing Spider-Man movies, can we agree Andrew Garfield was a pretty damn good Spider-Man?
I agree. I have a love for the Tobey Maguire movies, though, because I love Sam Raimi.
Me too.
So,
me too.
You know, so, but I mean, I'm excited for the new Spider-Man, so.
Are you? I mean, I know you work for Sony.
He's finally part of the Avengers, and be honest with you, I'm really sick of origin stories of Spider-Man. We all know at this point how he was made. Let's just get to Spider-Man, you know?
Well, that's the most important question. Mechanical or organic webs?
I'm still with organic. That's what it was in the comics, man. He was bitten and, you know.
No, in the comics, it was mechanical. The comics. Yeah, he built
it. I'm sorry.
He
was mechanical in the comics. Mm-hmm. Shit, I'm wrong. No, I'm still with the fact that it should be organic because I don't believe a high school student has the wit to put together something of Tony Stark level shooting webs, especially in his mom's house or his aunt's house.
The thing I don't want, you know, Uncle Ben is the guy that leads him, not Peter, or not Tony Stark. I'm worried there's going to be too much Tony Stark. It's going to be like Peter Starker, and I don't want that. I want Peter Parker.
No, but they're doing that. The only reason you know he's in the movie is to help sell the movie.
Yeah, you know? I know, but that's it makes me worried.
It's the same reason why all the Marvel movies has to have someone from another movie because they need to tie it all together for the Infinity Wars. So that's all it is. You know, Tony Stark's in there because he's contracted to do a certain amount of movies. Same reason why Nick Fury was in all those movies, just to get him in the movie, you know. fans of because they're taking a chance on an unknown actor for a Spider-Man. So that's why they surround him with a bunch of stars, especially Robert Downey Jr. Oh, Iron Man's in the movie. I'm going to go see it. And you know there's a big battle scene with him and Spider-Man, so you got to have it for the diehards. Because to bet a whole Marvel movie on a nobody is a big risk for them, you know?
Yeah, it is. You're right. I don't like it, but you're right.
That's the business side of it. It's always the business first. The fans, we get the last end of it, but the business part of it is you can't sell a movie like that. It's a perfect example of Predator 2. Predator is a great movie, but then you put Danny Glover, who's a great actor. He's not a leading man.
Yeah.
You put him in with the Predator and you surround him with a bunch of nobodies, except stands for Bill Pullman. But then you go to the movie just to see the Predator. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And it still didn't do well because you can't sell it. If Arnold Schwarzenegger made a cameo in Predator 2, boom, moneymaker. It's the same thing with Ghostbusters. If they had called it Ghostbusters 3 instead of Ghostbusters Again with the girls,
mm-hmm.
that movie would have made twice as much money.
You think so, huh?
Absolutely. Because it would have been the original crew. You would have gotten Venkman and Stance and everybody in there, and they would have handed the torch.
Yep, I agree with that.
Instead of just being a whole new thing. Because we already have the Ghostbusters lineage. You can't change it. And then you can't change the lineage and make it new and then throw in things like Slimer and the Stay Puffed balloon and all that. You can't throw throwbacks from the original movie because you made it a new movie, but you're still giving it an homage. So it made no sense.
And have the original actors playing different roles. That's just
different roles on top of it. It's like you threw them in there just for nothing. And then you put – if you left early, you never would have seen Ernie Hudson. You know, so it's like if you had had the original Ghostbusters, I would have believed that, yeah, they're older, they're tired, Spengler's dead, you know, from a ghost or whatever, and we're passing the torch. We're trained. If it was a training movie, you know, let's train them, you know, and they can go out and be Ghostbusters. Oh, man, it would have been amazing.
I don't know. I like that movie. I like it too.
But if you're a video game fanatic, I highly recommend playing Ghostbusters the video game, because that's actually the third Ghostbuster movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the one that came out a few years back, right?
Yeah, it came out for Xbox and PlayStation. Yeah, that was the original. That was the next Ghostbusters. But, you know, I digress.
No, that's cool that you still geek out over this stuff. Going back to my question like a while back, that's something that I really just feel – I was always concerned with, like, if you work in the business and you work and you see it regularly and you see makeup and you see prosthetics and you're working with this every day, it feels like it would make you somewhat disillusioned, but you're still invested in it. You seem you're still geeking out over this stuff.
Oh, how can I not? I mean, it's sort of like a dream job. I mean, I only wish I was doing this in the 80s when, you know, the really cool movies were out. Like, I would have loved to have worked on Back to the Future or even The Thing or Big Trouble in Little China, you know, the movies that I hold dear to my heart. I'm fortunate enough now that New York City is a television industry, so I'm getting to meet a lot of the actors that I grew up with. But in the television world, it's a cop show. I mean, it's a fed cop show. There's bullets and stuff. It's a great job. I'm fortunate enough to do makeups that are above network, in the sense that I'm getting to do like really disturbing makeups, like twigs out of someone's eyes or mummified bodies in the woods, things that you normally wouldn't see a lot of on a quote unquote procedural show, mm-hmm. you know, unless it's a medical show. So I love The Blacklist. I think it's a great avenue for me to do sort of like the horror aspect of makeup without actually being cheesy horror movies. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Totally.
You know, I've told this numerous times to anybody who will listen on the set of The Blacklist, that what we need on this show is a League of Doom episode where all of the blacklisters that are still alive figure out that Reddington is squawking to the cops and they all join forces to come get him.
Oh, yeah.
That'd be awesome.
Then you get like 10 of the hardest blacklisters that we haven't killed, and they all get together and use their resources to get at Reddington. I would love that. I would geek out with that stuff because it's like, oh, did you see that? They brought back this guy and they brought back Wu Jing and they brought back General Ludd and whoever's not dead. Anybody else not dead. I don't know who's not dead. But all those people, get them all together and they all come at Reddington at once. And it becomes a new type of cabal.
I love that. I love that idea. John, listen.
I've said that to John personally, and he liked it too. But, you know, it's got to be in the cards. I don't write the show. I just work on it.
That would be great. I gotta scream out, "Blacklisters assemble!" or something like that.
Seriously, I mean, people would go nuts, and it would give the audience a reason to go back to watch those origin episodes of each Blacklister. It's the same reason why the Marvel movies are doing so well, since they're all connected. You feel that you can't just watch Guardians, or you can't just watch Ant-Man or Thor without going back and seeing, oh, did you see that they mentioned Thor's hammer at the end of Iron Man 2, or they mentioned this and they tied this together. Nick Fury's here. And, you know, it's like all that connection is what the fans love. You know, it's not just about a 2-hour movie anymore. You go in, you see it, you're done. Okay, put it on the shelf. You know, but the Marvel Universe is so smart the way it's tying it all together. I only wish DC can get on it, you know, because I was a big DC fan when I grew up. You know, they just need to stop recasting Batman and Superman and lock someone down.
I think Superman's good for a little bit. I don't know about Batman, though. Ben Affleck seems a little, he's like wavering a little bit. He doesn't know where he wants to stay or not.
It just wasn't a strong story. I mean, there's so many brilliant comics out there with Superman and Batman. I would be okay if they just took off one of the comics. You know, they don't need to try and make this new story. They just need to, you know, come up with something that's smart enough to, cause I mean the Justice League cartoon, I was there every Saturday, watched it every single Saturday.
Were you?
I loved it, but I have no faith now. I haven't even seen Wonder Woman yet.
Which, oh, it's great. It's great.
Is fantastic.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, I got to see it. And do they at least do a tie-in to the next ones, the Justice League movies? Or like they set up Aquaman and Flash and all that?
Minimum. I wouldn't say a tie-in to it, but they do illustrate the modern day versus the years gone by. So
okay.
I don't want to say too much because I don't want to spoil
it. Don't say too much. Yeah, I'm gonna try and get my ass to the theater at some point. I got to see it. Plus, I'm a big 80s geek. You know, I love everything 80s. I was born in 75, so I kind of grew up right around the right time. I was a teenager in the 90s, so I have affinity for the 80s, you know. You know?
You should come by and do our Remake This Movie Right podcast sometime, man. You sound right up that alley. That's fun. Where we take.
Well, I've heard you guys talk about it, but I only have the app for Blacklist, so that's the only thing I listen to aside from, like, arcade stuff, because I do a lot of arcade stuff, too, like video games, so I don't listen to the other podcasts, but I definitely want to get into your Westworld one because I just finished watching Westworld.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah. That's a great show.
Amazing show. But Remake This Movie Right. What do you guys basically do? You take an old movie and like a bad movie?
No, not necessarily. We take a movie that's either has a remake in the works or one that listeners want us to do. And then we kind of talk about what we liked and didn't like about the original, and then kind of make our own version. Like, what do fans want to see in a modern remake? Instead of Hollywood dictating how it's going to be remade, we kind of put together our own movie, and then we have a parody trailer at the end.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, you know, they were talking about doing the remake of Big Trouble in Little China with Vin Diesel, I think it was.
The Rock.
Oh, The Rock. Mm-hmm. It was The Rock. See, I don't need that. You know, you can't strike lightning twice. Big Trouble in Little China is one of those, it's a period movie because it can never be recreated. The time frame, the mentality, the effects, everything about it can't be recreated. I got to meet John Carpenter once it was a Thing anniversary. And I asked him a question in front of a ton of people, and he gave me the most honest answer ever. Escape from New York. One of my favorite movies.
Mine too.
Love its death. It's so gritty. It's dark. It's dirty. It's awesome. Everything about it. So what were you thinking when you did Escape from LA? He goes, if you'd seen the check they wrote me, you'd have made that movie too. I was like, oh, shit. So it's one of those things where I don't agree with remakes. Like Escape from LA is an exact duplicate of New York. They just changed the locale. Absolutely. But it's the exact same characters, exact same story. Just done worse.
The effects house too was very poorly chosen.
Oh yeah, it was a garbage movie. Mm. You know, so it's one of those things where I don't agree with Hollywood making remakes because there was nothing wrong with the originals. You know, you make remakes of like 10,000 Maniacs or like try and find some of those really bad movies that. Here's a good remake: The Little Shop of Horrors, Roger Corman. I used to run a horror film festival with a friend of mine back in New York back in the early 2000s, and we had Roger Corman there. And I asked Roger, I'm like, listen, Little Shop of Horrors, total budget movie, get it. It was good for its time. How did you feel about the remake in 86? And he's like, it was the movie I wanted to make. It was brilliant. He goes, I could have done without being musical, but it was an amazing movie. So remakes like that actually take the product and completely 180 it and make it new mm-hmm. is amazing. But when you remake Texas Chainsaw or Nightmare on Elm Street or The Thing, I mean, who in their right mind okayed that? There was nothing wrong with the originals. I'm not going to show my – I'm having a son in 2 months. My wife is pregnant.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And it's funny because he's actually due the week I'm supposed to go back to the Blacklist. So I'm kind of figuring out how that's going to work. But I'm not going to show my kid Charlie and the Chocolate Factory by Tim Burton. I'm going to show him the Willy Wonka movie with Gene Wilder. And that's all. There's no reason for the remakes. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you're going to redo a movie, make it a sequel or make it something new, but with homage. Don't remake it. Don't give me the same story. Give me something completely different. They're remaking Killer Clowns from Outer Space. No
Why?
Reason.
Why?
Why? Exactly.
That's some product of its time. Yeah.
You know, they're actually, I had heard rumors about 2-3 years ago. One of my favorite movies of the 80s is The Last Dragon. Cheesy, kung fu. I don't know if you ever saw it.
Hell yeah. Show enough. Show enough. Faith
Prince. Yeah. So they want to remake that with Samuel Jackson.
What? Now,
you can't see. That's what I'm saying. Like, it's an 80s movie.
Yeah.
It was takes place in the 80s, 80s music, 80s pop, 80s mentality. You can't take that and put it in today's climate. Another perfect example. There was this artist named Taco back in the day, in the 80s. He sang Putting on the Ritz. Mm-hmm. And it was a one-hit wonder. The reason it did so well is because it was poppy, but it was a 1920s song during the Depression. But taking Depression era songs and putting them in the materialistic Reagan era just doesn't work. You know, it was cute for a second and then it dies out. Hollywood is doing the same thing by taking movies from the 60s and the 70s and now the 80s. Let's be honest, it's 30 years ago already. You know, the 80s. And what's going to where's the line? When are they going to remake Godfather? When are they going to remake Raging Bull or Rocky or Back to the Future? You know? So I'm nervous about Hollywood because kids today, and I see this a lot when we have young people on set, they have no idea who Fisher Stevens is. They have no idea who Ron Perlman is. They have no idea the history of cinema, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm just running off on a tangent now because I'm on my soapbox, but I'm just like, that's how I feel. Like, if you're going to work in cinema or if you're going to be a cinemaphile, you know, you should know the history instead of just accepting every piece of shit that Hollywood churns out down the line. You know what I mean?
No, it's we just not too long ago talked to S.S. Wilson, one of the creators of Tremors. I'm sure you know Tremors.
Oh yeah, Tremors, love it.
Yeah, and they're I don't know, Kevin Bacon apparently has rekindled his love for the property, and they're talking about revamping it as a TV series, but they didn't consult the showrunner, so they're going to do it completely different. Or the original creators are going to do it like their own different way, and it's just like, that's one of those things where if you're not going to do it with the people that were originally involved, just don't do it. I mean, I just don't see the point of it. Just let it go.
You're negating the original property mm-hmm. at that point. You know, you're telling the kids of today and tomorrow, why should I watch Nightmare on Elm Street, Wes Craven, when I got the new one, that hokey piece of shit that came out a couple years ago?
Right.
You know, why bother? Though the first one's too scary, I can't watch it. You know,
they'll never make it that scary again.
Oh, that makes sense. You know, I mean, it's just so weird, the climate today with, you know, aside from politics and everything, but the uncertainty of Hollywood, where they invest in movies that worked because they were out during the right time, doesn't necessarily mean it's going to work now. You know what I mean?
Right.
I don't think that's why I don't think there's no new thoughts in Hollywood. It's sad. It's like, where are those classics? Like, we talk about Mannequin and we talk about Big Trouble and The Thing and all those movies that we grew up on. But what are my kids going to look at for the movies of their day? What, like The Fault in the Stars and Marvel movies?
That's it.
You know, I mean, granted, Guardians of the Galaxy 2 was amazing, but it's not exactly the type of movie. I'm like, there's no more Jaws. You know, there's no more, you know, Cannonball Run. Any of that. You know, like, all those movies, that whole era of movie is gone. And it's sad in a way because there's just nothing to look forward to. You know, I don't even see horror movies anymore in the theater. I don't even bother. My biggest rule about horror movies is if it's not rated R, it's not worth it. And it seems that most horror movies today are PG-13.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I heard they're doing another Indiana Jones as well.
Yeah, he's almost 80. It's my favorite part. I love Indiana Jones, my favorite movie franchise. And even I'm like, I'd watch it, but man, can we be careful? He's going to break something.
Which was your favorite? Which was your favorite Indiana?
It's Temple of Doom. I know that's the least liked, but that's my favorite by a mile.
Temple of Doom is my, I honestly, I like Crusade because it pays. Well, I love Raiders. Don't get me wrong. I love Raiders. Mm-hmm. But Raiders was more of an adult movie. I was a little kid when Raiders came out, so I was scared by it.
Right.
So, you know, the whole thing with the opening of the Ark always scared me. But when Crusade came out and they pay homage to Raiders, you know, when they're in the catacombs and they see the Ark painted on the wall, it's those little things that I love. I love geeking out and stuff like that. But yeah, that's, you know, the gist of it all. I just feel that movies need to kind of figure their way out of this hole they've dug themselves in.
That's great. You know,
and if they can't come up with original ideas, then, you know, sequels always work. Walt Disney once said that he'll never make a sequel. And then literally, because he felt that if you can't tell a story in the 2 hours that you are showing the movie, then you shouldn't be telling that story. The first sequel in Disney came out after he died, and it was The Rescuers Down Under, mm-hmm. I believe, you know, which it did all right, you know, but no, most people don't remember that movie. They remember The Rescuers. But then you start getting Aladdin 3, Aladdin 4, Lion King 2, Lion King 3, Lion King 4. And it's like you're negating the property of the original story. You know, it doesn't make sense anymore. The only thing that works with sequels are like horror movies. I could see all the Friday the 13th. I could see all the Nightmare on Elm Street and all the Halloweens. But, you know, certain movies, either you make a really good sequel or you just don't do it. You come up with something completely different.
Toy Story works, though. Toy Story always works.
See, now they're making a new Toy Story. A Toy Story 4.
Yeah, they didn't.
That I'm not okay with.
They ended it. As far as I'm concerned, the story's over. Leave it alone. But Disney and Pixar are not going to let that kind of money go to waste. Mm-hmm. Cars 3, Angry Birds this, and Rio 5, and Madagascar 7. It's like, that's their properties. They're going to churn it out. Instead of just making original classics like we had when we were kids. Like, no one goes around saying, oh, man, Ghostbusters 2, classic. I love Ghostbusters 2. It's a great movie. But to me, Ghostbusters 2 is a side note to the original. You know, I saw Ghostbusters in the theater in 1984, loved every second of it. Gremlins, same thing. But, you know, we don't go around saying that about sequels. Nowadays, that's all the kids have are sequels. Oh, my 7-year-old niece, I'm like, hey, you want to watch Hotel Transylvania? She goes, no, put on the second one. Put on the second one. I'm like, there's a second one? When did they tell that? And like, she put on the second one. Nowhere near as good as the first one.
They had a second Hotel Transylvania?
Yeah, I like the original.
Oh, that's right. They did have another one. That's right.
There's a second one. It's the one with the boy. They got a little boy now, and he's turning into a vampire. And it's cute, but the joke is already over. You know what I mean? Like, it was funny in the first one, but then they kind of feel like you're just pulling the same jokes. So I liked it, but it's like, no, this is not right. You're supposed to watch the first one. Why do you think there's no Goonies 2?
I don't want that. Because it would just be weird to see them. Because you know, I'd have them all grown up. And I'm like, man, now you're just adults and sad. I don't need that.
But see, that's my point. It's like, you know, we don't need sequels and remakes of classics, or what I consider a classic. You know, obviously, you know, the movies from the 50s are classics, but they're only classics to, you know, the cinemaphiles. Like, I love Godfather. I love Dog Day Afternoon. I don't need to see Dog Day Afternoon 2.
You're right. This is a generation, this current generation is going to have a lesser amount of original classics. They're going to have a lot of regurgitated classics.
Yeah. And that's the sad part. That's the thing I have to protect my children from.
Fight the man. Fight the man.
Well, I even told them, like, you're going to start off playing an Atari 2600 and you're going to work your way up to an Xbox. You're not just going to jump right on the latest thing. You got to work your way up.
That poor kid's going to be so long before they get to the Xbox.
Oh, he's going to do it. He'll play Nintendo, play Sega, and work his way up.
That's awesome. So what do you do when you're not doing makeup effects, when you're working on the, I know we got to wrap the interview up, but what do you do when you're not working on the Blacklist?
Well, right now I'm on hiatus. We ended the show May 24th, and I do what's called day playing. Like, I'll get a call and I'll work on a couple of shows. I just worked on the President's Show for Comedy Central with a friend of mine who does the makeup. Mm-hmm. And like, I'm have Brushwell Hire. I'm an independent contractor. But the majority of the time, I actually am nesting right now because I have a kid coming. So I just painted the nursery and built a crib and get all that ready. And I'm a video game nut. I actually built an arcade machine in my house, like an actual 7-foot coin-op arcade that plays over 8,000 different games. So it's like I spend time as a hobby playing with that thing, tweaking it or setting it up, making it work. What else do I do? You know, landscaping, I work around the house and, you know, I just chill because after 21 years of doing makeup, you always have to look for your next job. It's crazy because, you know, you never know where your next check's coming from. Mm-hmm. And where I'm very fortunate with the Blacklist is I know come July 24th or whenever it is we come back to work, you know, I have a job for another 10 months so I can chill out and enjoy my summer a little bit, you know?
Awesome.
That's what I like to do.
Well, Anthony, thank you so much for being on, dude. I know this has been like a dream of ours to talk to people from New York after four seasons. So fantastic for the fans and just so cool that you listen to us too. Very flattered. So that's awesome.
I often joke at work where I think I'm the only person that actually watches the show because it's on Thursday nights. It's 10 o'clock. By the time we get home, we're asleep. We got to be at work the next morning, but I will watch it. Diego and I will watch it. And the next morning we talk about it and the ratings and, oh, this was great. And this was, you know, we like this, we didn't like this. Cause once we see the show and then when I discover that this app the Blacklist app, cause I was just Googling Blacklist, and you guys came up, I was hooked immediately because I had listened to another podcast about Blacklist and I realized they didn't know what the hell they were even talking about. Like they didn't know the character names or they didn't know this or that. And I'm like, these guys actually watch the show. And normally if I wasn't part of the Blacklist crew, I wouldn't watch it, you know, because it's just one of those shows that if you don't watch it from the beginning, you're out. You know, you can't catch up unless you have 80 plus hours of time to sit around and watch TV. Mm-hmm. So finding the app was a godsend because I could actually watch the show. And what really drives me nuts sometimes is that you guys don't post it till Saturday, but we air Thursday. So Friday, my drive into work, I got nothing. So I'm like, oh God, when are they going to get back? And then I'll forget on Saturday and then I won't listen to it till like Sunday or Monday. So it's one of those things. I'm like, I got to continuously catch up with the podcast. The interview you guys did with Susan was brilliant.
Thank you.
And she was so good. And the one you did with Amir, the next day I talked to Amir. I was like, dude, I heard your interview. It was great. I talked to Megan. I heard your interview. They're all great. You guys do some great interviews and you ask the right questions, you know? Even the one with Hisham was great too. I love all the interviews you guys do. You guys need to get Diego on there, but he's going to be a hard sell. He doesn't like doing interviews.
Why? We're fun. And
I know. And
tease
I'll tell
him about his hair.
I know Diego and he's not up for that shit. He's got a wife and a kid and he likes to do his family thing. He doesn't like doing interviews, but, you know what the get is? You need to get James. If you can get James, like the
okay, we'll call him.
Well, you never know. It could be like the last, like the day that the show finally meets its end, and it's the last episode. Mm-hmm. You know, and it'll be your last podcast. You never know, right?
No, you never. I mean, don't like we would tell him no. I'll be honest with you. I always tell Troy this. If James Spader came on, I would probably ask him so many questions that have nothing to do with the Blacklist because I'm a fan of his entire body of work. It's not one show.
So. You know? But yeah, like you can get all those guys. Like, you know, Glenn. You should get Glenn on there.
We would love to have Glenn. I would love to have Megan again just because it still floors me how she actually came back to us just because of one thing we did that, I mean, it just shows she's such a sweet person.
She really is. And she's a genuine person and I love her to death. And it was crazy at first when I met her because I was like, oh my God, the lead actress, but we bonded real quick. It was all about her scar at first because in season one, they had designed the scar on her wrist a certain way. Mm-hmm. And she wasn't a big fan of the whole prosthetic glue thing. So I had to come up with a way to make it as painless as possible for her. And we had gone through maybe three or four variations of the scar which is why some fans will actually notice that the scar moved a little bit. I saw it online years ago. Someone called me out on it saying, hey, the scar used to be on her palm and now it's on her wrist. And I'm like, well, you know what? Scars heal over time. That's my excuse. And the practicality of it is that if you put any kind of makeup on a joint, like a wrist, it's not going to stay. And let's be honest, you want me to chase this scar around for the next 8 hours? Megan don't want that, and I don't want that. So let's just, you know, make it easy for everybody. That's why it's there, but you never always see it. But we know it's there.
That's great.
So, yeah. But listen, thank you guys again. I really enjoyed this. I can't wait to hear it.
Well, absolutely. And hopefully you can come back maybe sometime next season too.
Yeah. If I still have a job, then yeah, I'm down.
You'll be good. You'll
be fine. Yeah,
absolutely. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for coming by, man. Really appreciate it, Anthony.
All right. Have a good night, guys. Bye-bye.
Have a good night.
All right. I hope you guys really enjoyed that because I freaking love that interview. He was great to talk to. One of the most engaging, interesting guys we've interviewed in a long time. Really open to any discussion we wanted. So hope you enjoyed it. Hope you got some insight into television and the business and what makeup artists do. And hopefully you just took something from it. Please find more interviews at thehollywoodoutsider.com. We're also on Spotify, iHeartRadio, or your podcast app of choice. You can also go to thehollywoodoutsider.com, like I said. Feedback at thehollywoodoutsider.com if you have any thoughts you want to send us. And you can also support the show at patreon.com/thehollywoodoutsider. Thank you guys so much for listening. I hope you love this. And remember, the next time you go to a theater or sit comfortably on your couch and watch The Blacklist this fall on NBC, buy popcorn.